This week, we're off to the Top End to meet a man who loves picking mangoes so much he bought his own farm and spends his holidays harvesting fruit. We'll find out how making sourdough bread is helping residents at a drug rehabilitation farm. And we'll join a retired farmer and his family as they prepare for auction day, where they're putting a prized collection of vintage tractors up for sale.
We never knew what he was going to do when he retired because he didn't have any hobbies. It was either farming or community work, and that was it. So the fact that he fell into something was probably pretty handy. But, you know, in some respects, maybe it would have been easier if he collected, like, matchbox cars. You know, you start collecting tractors, seriously, sheds and more sheds. But you know what? He loves it. And he's got such a huge community of friends, not just in Australia but worldwide. That's worth it.
Yes, but collecting tractors is not a great hobby if storage space is an issue. That story coming up. First, though, let's head out with a farmer who's harvesting a tasty and aromatic succulent that's in demand from chefs and could be the answer for farmers struggling to grow anything on salty land.
I'll just show you a couple of...
As sheep farmer David Thompson drives along the salt flats at his property in southern Western Australia, a bushy green plant catches his eye.
Nothing else grows here. Even the salt bushes all died. But look, this is thriving, the samphire. Have a look at that.
On this salty land, where very little can survive, samphire, a native succulent with edible green stems, is proving to be hardy in tough conditions.
So that's how we harvest it. We just clip like that. And that goes in a pack, away it goes.
Hello, I'm Olivia Garnett. David is showing me how he harvests this tasty plant that he thinks could be a winner for farmers looking to earn money from land that normally wouldn't turn a cent.
So you've got to get the succulent tips, so not the woody bits down below. Magic. And that's growing in country that's, as you can see, nothing else can grow here. But this is thriving. Its name is called sea asparagus, so it's actually something adapted to these toxic environments. If we can grow them commercially, I think there's just enormous potential for this. You can just see how healthy that looks. We've just got to understand the plant and learn how to grow it properly. I think the world market for this sort of stuff is huge, absolutely huge.
Through his business, Mujipin Foods, David is on track to setting up a samphire industry for WA, which he describes as the capital of the world for salt-affected land.
It's a native Ceylon-tolerant plant. It's probably the most tolerant plant that grows on land. It'll grow in land that nothing else will survive in. It's a halophyte, so it will take salt out of the soil. It's adapted to living in a toxic environment, and we're getting more and more of land suitable for it every day. Mm.
Can you explain how you go about eating a product like this?
Well, I suppose chefs do it in different ways, but it's not a plant you'd actually eat fresh. Some people like it, but generally it's something that you blanch, and then ideally it will be with fish. That's a sort of choice dish with samphire. Soft cheese, red wine, everything. Beer, it's great. It's really, really good. As opposed to having gherkins or those sorts of products, olives, I think this is a really good addition to that market.
Can we taste it?
Sure.
Much like a caper sort of look,
yeah,
but it's
right.
More of a worm shape.
Is that right?
Less bitter than the fresh version.
Mm.
It's crunchy, isn't
it? It's crunchy, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And the bitterness gone, but it's still got that salt kick to it. I think it's a cracking thing. It's almost a staple plant in the Northern Hemisphere. Just in this country, no one knows what to do with it. And the varieties we've got, I think, complement the Northern Hemisphere's varieties very well. So when their season finishes, our season would start. So we think there's a really great opportunity to export this product into an established market in the Northern Hemisphere.
What is samphire worth?
Look, it's about $20 a kilo that we sell it for. But you can't grow anything else on that land. That's the thing. Mm. So we haven't worked on yield yet because it's really just foraging at the moment, but we think the yield potential is per hectare is very high.
You said the samphire thrives in otherwise toxic land. Where does it grow in Australia?
A lot of it grows on along the coast. And a lot of people don't realise it can grow inland. And we've probably got 500,000 hectares that's suitable for samphire. And people don't realise what the plant is. And it's just been allowed to grow across salt flats. And generally it's been... I've had people ask me, how do you kill it to get rid of it? And I think, why would you want to kill this? It's the last plant on earth that'll grow in some of this areas. Let's grow it and make something out of it.
What sort of volumes are you picking now?
Sampa, we're picking around 20 kilos a week. This doesn't sound much, but when you're actually doing it, it's quite a bit. Mm. But the good thing about Sampa is it's really heavy. Like, it's just nearly all water. But we think we can lift our production tenfold within the next 2 years. Mm.
Where does your product go?
Most of our sapphire goes to Sydney and Melbourne. We do send stuff to the west coast, to the Margaret River, but our biggest market now is Sydney and Melbourne. We've only just scratched the surface of it.
You mentioned the Netherlands. Where else is it grown commercially?
Well, the Netherlands are probably the biggest. So they grow it in greenhouses there. There's stuff grown in Ireland as well. America? Yes, on the east coast. Yeah, there's but not the varieties that we've got here. The world market knows about it, so it's just a matter of getting the product out there, I think.
How does it go with frost?
Not a problem. It's full of salt, so we haven't seen any frost damage. There's no weeds because nothing else will grow, and no insect damage. Nothing will eat it, so it's really quite a unique plant.
It's pretty exciting that a valuable product could be grown in otherwise unusable land. What opportunities exist for other Great Southern farmers or WA farmers to also grow samphire?
We'd like them to grow for us. I mean, we'll need more product. We'd love other farmers to come on board, but we've got to get the concept proven and make sure that everything's in place. But we think the upside is enormous, so we'd need more people to come, and we'd like to roll this out so we can have other farmers use that land that they can get nothing from now, not a cent, but we can actually make some money for them.
Well, I've been here for 6 months, and it's actually really changed my life around. I've been using meth for 22 years. I came in here very lost and broken, and a lot of my relationships with my family and friends were ruined. I kind of had nothing left.
As Paul Nichols speaks, he kneads a ball of sourdough with his hands.
It teaches you so much about, you know, learning compassion again and learning that there's other people in the world to think about, and doing things like this baking gives you the passion again to do good things, you know?
The smell of fresh bread wafting from a commercial kitchen filled with people laughing and talking is probably not what you'd expect at a drug rehabilitation centre, but it's exactly what's happening here. Hello, I'm Laura Meacham. I'm at Hope Springs Community Farm, just out of Geraldton, 400 kilometres north of Perth, in Western Australia. Here, residents like Paul are baking artisan sourdough bread to be sold at a local market.
I'm a welder by trade, so I've done a lot of welding and things like that. And coming in and using bread, at first I was like, I don't know if I like this. This is hard because it's something I never did before. But after doing it for a while and learning it and giving it a good shot, it's second nature now. It's great, I love it. I think it gives you, like, it settles you down. When you come in and you've been very erratic with life, and when life hasn't been too good to you, you don't know where you fit. So it keeps you settled, it keeps you focused on doing things. You've got to be quite calm and relaxed because everything works on a time frame. And because it's a process, so you're doing it over a few days of the week, the process works really well to just keep your mind and talking with friends. If you've got problems, if you're not feeling great one day, or you can be in here just doing this, just chatting.
The farm is based on the same model used at San Patrignano, a world-renowned recovery community in Italy. It has a philosophy of teaching participants new skills to boost their self-esteem and encourage them to respect themselves and others. Andy Niblock is the regional manager with Hope Community Services. He says the farm program offers a unique approach to addiction support.
Probably has more of a social educational component, in the sense that Hope sees addiction really as more of a behavioural, a lifestyle issue. Within our farm program, it's a holistic program, so it very much it's person-centred, and from the moment someone joins our program, makes that brave, courageous decision, we involve them into the day-to-day running of how the farm operates. So from day one, participants are getting a chance to practice their life skills, or maybe to regain life skills that sometimes people have lost in the course of their life, or particularly around when their drug or alcohol use has become problematic. One of the key ways we've really found is powerful for people in their journey of change is helping them to be involved in creative aspects. So one of the main ways we've done that over the past probably 4 or 5 years is is through residents and participants making some artisan bread.
For resident Corey Dempsey, the Hope Farm approach has helped him in ways other rehab programs haven't been able to.
Been here for 4 months. This is my third attempt at rehab, but this one's completely different to the others, so it's been going well for me. The other ones, I went to one in Darwin, which was mostly for people coming out of jail through corrections, so I didn't really want to be there. I only lasted after a couple of months there. Last year, I was at another rehab. It was just wasn't anything like this. It was a lot bigger, a lot more people, a lot more clinical. It didn't really work, but this place has gone well for me.
Andy Niblock says making bread has proved to be a really successful form of therapy for residents.
In terms of a therapeutic approach, the bread is an awesome way of helping people to sometimes slow down things and take their time. People have to show patience. They have to learn to work in a team because there's a few bakers at any one time who will be making the product. They have to learn to communicate and they have to learn to work to particular orders that have been given for that product and to follow, obviously, a process of how something's made. So therapeutically, it's a wonderful way of just helping people to, I guess, explore more about their identity or how they change themselves. Mm.
Is this what you thought a rehab centre would be like?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I thought it was going to be more clinical, more, you can't do this, you can't do that. Definitely did not think that doing, rehabilitation would be on a farm and living in a community with people. It's definitely nothing what I thought it would be like, no. I just think that, projects like this can change people's life. You know, if you really want to do it, things like this can really change people's lives, and it's what people are doing here. People come out and they're taking time out of their lives to come and help people like us that struggle. You know, so it does. It really does change people's lives around. It's fantastic.
Has it changed your life?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I came in here very angry man, very lost, broken, confused, didn't know what I was doing. Now, I'm nothing like the person I came in 6 months ago.
For Corey Dempsey, making bread and being part of a team has helped him to like himself more.
I have a lot more respect for people now. I was quite selfish before I came in here. And just working as a community. And I'm just a lot nicer, I guess. I'm a better person.
Corey Dempsey is taking part in a drug rehabilitation program at Hope Springs Community Farm in Geraldton in Western Australia, where residents are baking bread as part of their therapy. That report from Laura Meacham. You're with the Country Breakfast on RN. Coming up, we're going to pick some mangoes in the top end. It's a sweaty, sticky job and one that lots of people really don't enjoy, but we're going to meet an exception. And a retired farmer is preparing to say goodbye to a much-loved machinery collection.
Eric Larson's shed is filled to the brim with tractors. To him, they are more than just a piece of machinery.
Well, they're an essential part of farming. So if you're farming, you've got to have a tractor. All my tractors are pretty simple. No bloody computers, no nothing. And you don't have to be a scientist to do a little bit of work on them. Yeah.
This hobby has taken the former dairy farmer around the world.
Well, that's the beauty of it, I've got friends all around the world, I can go to Western Australia and stay with friends, I can go anywhere and just stay with friends, friends in America who have got this red in their blood too.
Hello, I'm Simone Smith. I'm here with Eric in the tractor shed on his property at Jellybrand in the Otway Ranges in southwest Victoria. There's 36 tractors in Eric's collection, but not for much longer. Eric is preparing to sell his prized collection at an upcoming auction before he leaves the farm and moves into town. It's an emotional time and marks the end of a long-time machinery obsession.
Tractors have always been an integral part of your life, and when I found one down the bush and if I could get out I could have it, well, I'd say it's like getting cancer, you've got to have a bloody hit every now and again. It just keeps growing.
Some of Eric's tractors are more than 80 years old, and all of them have one thing in common. They're all the same brand, International Harvester.
Probably because they were made in Geelong, one thing in their favour. Yeah, but, you know, between me and my brothers and nephews, we had 14 at one stage and they never let us down.
I mean, I guess the good thing was we never knew what he was going to do when he retired because he didn't have any hobbies. So it was either farming or community work and that was it. So the fact that he fell into something was probably pretty handy. But, you know, in some respects, maybe it would have been easier if he collected, like, matchbox cars. You know, you start collecting tractors, seriously, sheds and more sheds. So, yeah, but you know what? He loves it. And he's got such a huge community of friends, not just in Australia but worldwide. So, you know, that's worth it. That's worth it.
Eric's daughter, Marie. She said her parents had always planned to sell the farm and move into town, but that won't make sale day any easier.
It's going to be really hard, I guess, because Dad loves them so much and it's been such a big part of his retirement. So that'll be hard. But you know what? He's been out here on the farm for 60 years. Mum was a city girl and came down to the country to teach. So she's had 60 years of being a farmer's wife and a tractor collector's wife. So it's kind of her turn, I guess. So it'll be nice for them to, you know, to go into Colac. Just make it a bit easier on Mum with all the travelling.
On auction day, Eric will be supported by friends and family, many of whom share a love of tractors from yesteryear. Vintage tractor enthusiast Alan Billings says he and Eric have bonded over their shared passion.
I think the main thing is that we have a shared interest. So you start to communicate with people about your interest, about what they're doing with their particular toys. So there's a bond does develop there. The older tractors, you can usually pull them apart and rebuild them quite easily, all steel and rubber. Whereas the new tractors, or the modern tractor, has got a lot of electronics in it. They'll probably go out of date and can't be replaced in sort of 10 or 12 years. Some of those tractors are 70 or 80 years old and they're still running. I'm not sure that the current tractor, when it's 70 years old, will still be running. The older equipment just has its own fascination. Yeah.
Keith Callan has been friends with Eric since they met at a tractor show many years ago.
I was looking to join a tractor club and Eric was out there representing the International Harvester Club. Met him then and had a chat to him and have been friends ever since. I was raised on a farm and drove a tractor from when I was hardly able to walk and you don't lose that interest. It's there with you all the time. So tractors are a great thing, they're easy to work on, not too hard to start, not like the new ones which is all electronics. But you can fiddle around and get them going yourself, which is quite good. And knowing someone like Eric too, it really makes it well worthwhile.
There's not two there the same, they're all different, so that's something in their advantage. And most of them, you know, 95% of them, you just hop off and start them and away they go. And, you know, they've mostly been repainted and cleaned up and had what mechanical needed doing to them to get them going. Yeah. But you know, as I say, the market slipped the last couple of years. There has been a couple of good sales in the last few months, but whether it'll happen here, and I'm not expecting big things. I'm not a praying man, but I should.
It's mid-afternoon, around 33 degrees, 65% humidity, and John Ho is walking around his mango farm in a pointed straw hat, picking mangoes with a long pole. He's in his element. And plastered across his face is a big smile.
When you love something, you do something, you don't care what condition of the weather, it's hot or cold, you know, and you just keep picking. I can stand out there with a bottle of water and picking from dawn to dusk, you know. I have no complaint about that at all. So I'm pretty happy.
John's love of picking mangoes started when a friend asked him to come out to his farm and give him a hand one harvest season. Once he started picking, John realised he loved it so much that he just wanted to keep doing it.
I thought to myself that why don't I start, you know, to have my own farm so I can pick as much as I like. So I just, you know, bought this farm, this land with, you know, my cousin, the next block. to help him a bit, but mostly I would really want to develop a mango farm.
G'day, I'm Dan Fitzgerald, and I'm here with John on his small farm on the outskirts of Darwin in the Northern Territory. John bought this block back in 1997, and after clearing the land, he planted around 1,000 mango trees on it. When he first started, John knew next to nothing about growing mangoes. He ended up asking a lot of questions and made a few mistakes, like planting the mangoes a bit too far apart. But he made it his mission to learn how to be a good mango farmer.
When you love to do something, you feel that really willing to learn something. And then over the years, I got some experience. And I learned how to look after the mangoes properly, how to make it look colorful, you know. And, you know, learn how to spray and, you know, treat chemical treatment properly, do it properly, do the right things. And, since then I got some experience, you know what to do.
John is not a full-time mango farmer. He actually works in the tech services department at the ABC. But he used all his free time on weekends to slowly build up his mango block.
I got about two days per week. And instead of spend 2 days, you know, enjoy myself, you know, relax, I relax in by, do the mango for those 2 days. And I feel very happy because when you love to do something, you know, enjoy doing something, your hobby, you know, you feel that no problem at all. I mean, I'm very happy for that, yeah.
And to make time for harvesting his mangoes, John uses up the couple of weeks annual leave he gets from his ABC job.
Instead of, going away for holiday, I would like to spend most of the time for picking the mango. Like this year, I took about 5 weeks off just for the mango season. I'm very happy with that, yeah.
And you don't mind that you don't get any holiday?
No, this is my holiday. Yeah, picking mango is my holiday. And, apart from that, you know, I feel happy because of what I've done here. I got some outcomes, a little bit, but then it will help me to help other people, you know, the people in need. So that's what I really love to do. Yeah.
And is it a good reward to see a full mango coming off your tree after you've spent so many weekends working on it throughout the year?
That's a good question. Yeah, when you see, when you start seeing some flower, you know, coming out, and then you can see the flower develop different style until it got some fruit, and it come mature, and you pick, you feel very happy. And I see that, that's the happy, you can see things develop, you know, from flower, slowly become the fruit, and become and ready to pick, and then when delivered to the customers, you know. I'd really like to do this thing because I can say that I like to make everybody happy, you know, that the worker got something to do, the people at the packing shed, you know, got something to do and be happy, and the agent got some job, and then the customer would be happy if the mangoes do it properly and it's have a good quality.
John is originally from Vietnam, coming to Australia as a refugee in 1981 after spending 6 months in a refugee camp in Malaysia. He knew hardly any English when he arrived, but worked hard at classes at Darwin Community College until he could grasp the local lingo. Upon graduation, he landed a job with the ABC, where he's been for over 35 years. And now, with his mango farm and plenty of mangoes to pick each year, he feels very happy with how far he's come.
I feel great because on the effort I have made so far, I just got some good results, you know, some results. And look at the mango, tree. When you go, you've been here. When I'm going down here, you know, I feel very relaxed. Look at the tree, greeny trees, and I feel very good environment, you know. That's why, you know, I want to make this area here is a peaceful place for everyone, you know, even the birds, you know. So no one allowed to shoot on my land, you know. I don't want any plug here, you know. I want everything in this place a peaceful one and a good environment for everybody to enjoy, even the creature, you know, like the birds, and, you know, they'd be happy too. So I'm happy with that.
John Ho is a mango farmer in the Northern Territory. He was speaking with our reporter Dan Fitzgerald from his small farm on the outskirts of Darwin. And you can see photos of John hard at work harvesting fruit with a big smile on his face on our website. Just head to the RN homepage and look for a country breakfast.